some thoughts on what it means to be a Buddhist in 2023 in the West, in North America, and where we're at. Buddhism is relatively new in the West, maybe 50 or 75 years, depending on how you want to calculate it. It took hundreds of years, actually 1,000 years or more, for Buddhism to go from India to Tibet. 75 years compared to that is not very long. There's always been controversy in Buddhism. Even the Buddha himself was challenged by various people at various times and for various reasons. Even in Tibet, there have been controversies. Sakyapandita's writings were considered very radical when he published them, some of the writings. Gorampa, who's considered one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Sakya scholars of all time, his writings were banned in Tibet when they first came out because the Lhasa government was controlled by the Gelugpas and Gorampa challenged Tsongkhapa. Today, there's no shortage of controversies in Buddhism. There's a long history of challenging and even debating it even today is still a major component in some of the philosophy colleges and shudras. Controversial statements, when they're debated, sometimes end up being valid later on. One of the teachers today who is not shy about making controversial statements is Dzogchen Zenzi Rinpoche. And he was asked what the greatest threat to Buddhism is in the modern world. And interestingly enough, his answer was culture. Culture is the greatest threat to Buddhism because Buddhism, at least on this planet, is followed by human beings. And wherever you have human beings, you have culture. The challenge is to separate what is culture and what is dharma. If we really look at that, that's something that is ongoing, that challenge and that separating out. Speaking specifically about Mahayana Buddhism, in the West these days, the biggest contributor to the transfer of Mahayana to the West comes from Tibetan Buddhism. Tibetan culture is quite different than Western culture, North American culture. A lot of what we call Dharma is mixed with Tibetan culture. That can be a little bit challenging for a Westerner. There's a lot of words, there's a lot of ceremonies, there's a lot of pictures, there's a lot of rules, belief systems that are mixed up with Tibetan culture. That's not to say they're all invalid. But on the other hand, not all of them are valid for us. We need to be attentive. I think we need to pay a little bit more attention to that. And I think that's what Rinpoche is suggesting. That's in terms of the culture coming from Tibet or Tibetan culture, Tibetans in India or Nepal. But there's also our side of the picture, which is our culture. Our culture getting mixed up in Buddhism. One of the ways where that's really evident today is the popularity of what's called mindfulness, which is very popular in some places in the West. And it's gotten a little bit confusing in some situations because, first of all, the word mindfulness, the meaning of it has been changed quite a bit from Mahayana meaning to Western cultural meaning. It's my opinion that that has happened because the word meditation has a lot of connotations which are negative for a lot of people, certain groups especially. And so to substitute the word meditation with the word mindfulness is a convenient marketing strategy. We see a lot of what originated in Buddhism being sold on the marketplace without it even being acknowledged that the source is the Buddha. Money and marketing are a big part of Western culture, and that has seeped into the present day situation quite a bit. There are also cases where there have been conflicts between cultures about what constitutes morality and immorality. We've seen that in a number of situations. So there are cultural, I don't know if I want to call them barriers, but culture and dharma have been mixed up on both sides of the fence. On the senders of dharma and the receivers of dharma. Dzogchen Rinpoche says that is, or will be anyway, the biggest challenge. I don't know if it's the biggest challenge, but it's certainly something that I think we need to pay a little more attention to and sort out a little better. And I think if we did that, it would make things easier for everybody. We as Westerners would have a clearer idea of how Dharma fits into our culture. People who are from another culture and look at us, maybe they will understand a little bit better why we're interpreting the Dharma the way we are. Dharma has always adapted to any culture that it went into. If you look at Dharma in India or Tibet, it's very different in form than what you see in Japan, for example. In a Zen temple, you don't see lots of tankas and paintings and colorful decorations all over the place like you might in a Tibetan temple. If you go to Southeast Asia, you see a different look. If you go to China or anywhere where Buddhism has entered into the culture in depth over a long period of time, you will see that it has taken different shapes and forms. When Padmasambhava went from India to Tibet, he spent a lot of time subduing and taming the local wild spirits, the demons or whatever you want to call them. If you go into other cultures, that's hardly mentioned. Was Tibet particularly full of demons? I've heard lamas say, yes, it was, that it was a really wild place. I don't know. Anyway, my point is that Buddhism is flexible enough to adapt to a certain degree to whatever culture that it's entering. But on the other hand, like I said earlier, we need to sort it out. We need to understand better for ourselves, and I think also for others too, what in our culture can receive Dharma without polluting it, and what in the Dharma is culture from another culture that we don't need to take on. Those are my thoughts about what I think Rinpoche might have meant when he said culture was the biggest threat to Western Dharma. I'm just raising the point and giving my thoughts about it, and I think that paying attention to this might be useful in the near future because we're at the point now in the West that there's quite a bit of Dharma arriving all over the place, and it's quite mixed up with other cultures. So we have an opportunity, but I think we also have somewhat of an obligation to think about this and sort through it a little bit more.
Thank you for those thoughts. Do you think that we're so steeped in psychology in the West that we reference Buddhism in psychological terms a lot? Like the Jungian theories and other psychological referencing that we were raised with in our culture, that we're kind of mixing up Buddhism with psychology?
Well, I think that depends who you're listening to. There is an aspect of Buddhism that is psychology. And one of the classic questions is Buddhism a religion? Is it a philosophy? Is it a psychology? Is it a way of life? Is it a worldview? My answer is yes, all of the above. It's a hybrid. It's certainly a religion in the sense that we have deities and we do supplications and ceremonies and all of the things that many religions have. We also have an ethical code, which many religions have. I don't think you can say it's not a religion. On the other hand, there's a heavy philosophical emphasis in Mahayana. If you want to say it's a philosophy, yes, it is. If you want to say it's a way to lead your life, it is. I don't worry about the question too much, but a lot of people seem to ask that question. I think it's a little bit confusing to someone looking in from the outside. My answer is it's a hybrid. And I think one of the great appealing aspects of Buddhism is its vastness. They say that Buddha taught 84,000 teachings because there's lots of different kinds of people in the world, lots of different kinds of beings in all the worlds. But His Holiness 41st Sakyatrizin said that that 84,000 is just a number, that's how many teachings one person heard and wrote down. But in fact, the Buddhist teachings are infinite because the number of sentient beings is infinite. Buddhism has, I think it has something for everybody in terms of practice styles. If you are a singer, there's plenty of things you can sing. If you're a poet, there's Buddhist poetry, there's chanting, there's dance, there's art, there's philosophy, there's science, the science of mind. This Buddhist science of mind is really advanced. Quantum physics is just catching up to Shakyamuni Buddha. Buddhism is for the benefit of sentient beings. It's not like the Buddha showed up and said, okay, I'm going to found a religion and it's going to be called Buddhism. He came looking for the truth. That's one of the meanings of the word Dharma, is truth. As far as guidelines and codes of behavior, at least in terms of his monastics, in the beginning, he didn't set down a bunch of rules. But if something happened that was questionable and the monastics came to him and said, what about this? Then at that point, he would make a rule. Okay, you can't do that. For example, monastics are not allowed to go around cutting down trees and pulling up grass. Well, probably that was because one day somebody did that, and so the question arose, is this okay? The Buddha was the first environmentalist. He issued guidelines around how to behave in relationship to the environment. The point I'm trying to make is that Buddhism has a great flexibility and a great breadth. It's very encompassing, apart from grossly immoral activities, lying, stealing, killing, and things like that. There is a fair amount of room to adapt to the needs of the practitioners and the situation that they're in. And there are stories illustrating that, quite a few, actually. If somebody has a psychological background and they want to try to find some correlation, I think that's a fairly natural thing to do. We're always looking for a peg where we can hang our coat. We're always looking for relating to something that we already know. That's how
Right.
we operate pretty much. And so I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that, as long as we separate the differences between the two. I think in terms of Jungian psychology, I'm not an expert in that, but I think you can argue that there are some similarities, there are some crossovers, there are some meeting points. That's not to say that Dharma and Jungian psychology are 100% identical, or any kind of psychology for that matter. I think the exploration of it is good if it's done honestly and openly with an open mind. The teachers say over and over again, if you want to really practice Buddhism, you need to listen to the teachings. You need to contemplate the teachings. Think about it. Clarify it in your own mind. See if there's any questions that you have. What was the teaching and what wasn't the teaching? What the teaching was and what the teaching wasn't. You need to clarify that. If you have a question, you need to answer the question. Go to a teacher or look it up or whatever. And then and only then do you meditate on it so that it goes in deeper and it can sink into your core being and belief systems and behaviors. Comparing psychological schools and examining that, if it's done right, I think you could say that's under the contemplation category. The process of sorting through it and understanding it more clearly. It's like everything. It depends on how you do it. It depends on your motivation and it depends on your willingness to be open-minded and honest about the exploration that you're doing.
I
I think
think.
we just need to recognize what I said in the beginning, that we're, historically speaking, we're at the beginning of this process in the West. We're figuring it out. We're learning how to do the practices. We're hopefully doing the practices and realizing that Dharma is not what you read in a book or even what you hear somebody say. True Dharma is the result, the realization that you get from doing the practice. That's Dharma. And there's lots of people reading books. There's lots and lots of books in the West, in lots of languages now, Western languages. The question is, how many people are doing practices? That's the question for ourselves. Am I doing the practice? I read a lot of books. Now, am I doing anything with it? Am I putting it into my life? Am I sitting down on my cushion and meditating? If you're not meditating, how can you call yourself a Buddhist? So we need to learn how to meditate correctly and do it. We always need to go to that integration step, the realization step, or whatever you want to call it. If you just have a big library with a bunch of books, you can't really call yourself a Dharma practitioner. You call yourself a person with a bunch of books. That's okay. Books are nice. I have a lot of books. But if I'm not going and doing the practice myself, not only am I not a practitioner, but I'm throwing away a precious opportunity that I've gotten with great difficulty, the precious human rebirth, very difficult to obtain. And if I'm not practicing during this precious human rebirth, well, fool doesn't even begin to describe who I am. There's an example that's used. If a lot of traders got in a boat, in a sailboat, talking about centuries ago, and went across the great oceans in search of the famous mythical island of jewels, and then they actually found it. They found the island that was full of jewels, and they go up to the shore and they go, "Wow, isn't this pretty? Nice jewels." And they turn around and leave without taking any jewels back. They've wasted their entire efforts. And that's kind of where we are with precious human rebirth. We've accumulated a huge amount of merit just to have a precious human rebirth with all 18 qualities, all 18 boxes being ticked to qualify as a precious human rebirth. It isn't just human rebirth, but precious human rebirth, which has numerous qualities. And we've obtained that with a lot of difficulty. And then we just read books. We're like the merchants that leave the island without any jewels. We haven't really understood what it takes to develop spiritually from a Dharma point of view. There's a saying, a good practitioner doesn't wear out the soles of their shoes, they wear out the seat of their pants. Take a look at your trousers and see.